So thank you for a kind invitation to come to PI and give a seminar on the color code. So in the talk, I will be talking about different problems I've been thinking of in the past few years. And there's a common denominator, which is the color code. It's a very interesting model. And my talk is kind of modular. I'll try to discuss some past projects with Michael Beverland or Benny Yoshida and Fernando Pastowski, as well as some ongoing work with my collaborators, including Fernando Brandão, Nicola Delfos, John Preskill, and Christas Fori. So let's get started. Our goal is to build a quantum computer. And we are excited to do that because quantum computation promises a lot. It can help us with simulation of quantum systems, quantum many-body systems. And also, if we have a quantum computer, we can run on it quantum algorithms, which can outperform the best known classical algorithms, for instance, for factorization. Unfortunately, it's not that easy to build a quantum computer. And unwanted interactions with the environment will lead to errors. So if we have our quantum memory, our quantum computer, there would be some thermal noise. And such a noise would cause problems. However, don't worry, because we can build a quantum computer. Namely, if we have some sufficiently weak noise, we can basically scale it up. And our quantum computer will be able to handle errors, given they are sufficiently weak and sufficiently uncorrelated. But it seems that it's a necessary step to have methods of controlling and correcting errors. Our task is not only to store quantum information, we would like to perform computation on it. And because of that, logical operators, which we implement, should be fault tolerant and easy to implement. So throughout the talk, the main emphasis will be on topological quantum codes. So let's quickly review those. Topological quantum codes are interesting because they have geometrically local generators. We can think of them as basically a system of qubits placed on some manifold, say on a torus, and then we need to have access only to local patches of the system, which we need to measure. And topological quantum codes are particularly well suited for local noise because those codes encode information in non-local degrees of freedom. And the very famous example is the toric code. And in my talk, I will focus on the color code. As I said, those topological codes seem to be experimentally realizable because we can have two-dimensional architecture. Once we know how to build a patch of 5 by 5 qubits, we can imagine that we know how to build 500 by 500. Of course, you know, in real life, it gets more challenging. But at least we don't see any physical obstacles toward building a big quantum computer. And there have been some experiments. For instance, this is an experiment implemented in the Martinez group in which they had 5 physical qubits and 4 Ancilla qubits, and they managed to measure neighboring ZZ operators. So it's still not a fully working quantum computer, but it's a step toward. And topological quantum codes exhibit important properties such as low weight measurements. In case of the toric code, it's just 4 qubits. There are efficient decoders, which we can use to encode to decode topological codes. Those codes exhibit high threshold, which is the maximal level of noise codes can handle. And there seem to be easy to implement fault-tolerant logical gates with them, especially in the color code. And a side remark is that topological quantum codes are particularly interesting to many researchers, including myself, because they can provide toy models exactly solvable for more complicated problems, like classification of quantum phases. So
I've got a question about the The high threshold, can you give me some sense of the typical assumptions of the error model that lead to the high threshold?
Right. So for instance, if you were to look at the threshold of the Turek code, you usually think of an independent depolarizing channel. And then this threshold for perfect measurements is of the order of 10% when you assume phenomenological noise model, meaning your syndrome is flipped with certain probability, then the threshold goes down to 3%. If you were to analyze the circuit level threshold, which is you have Ancilla qubits and you have to perform syndrome to extract, you have to perform some circuit to extract syndrome, then the threshold goes to 1%. But for more sophisticated noise models, you know, it varies, but it's a noise model dependent. I've been thinking of the simplest case, which is the depolarizing channel. So that's what I can talk about. But when the noise model is more complicated, in particular when you have some coherent noise model, then you know it gets messier because we need to understand how to decode those more complicated noise models better to implement better decoders.
And you know, the strength of it is its resilience to local errors.
Yes.
But if you think about a physical implementation like Martinez here, you're going to have global magnetic fields that are going to throw everything off. I mean, that could be controlled to some extent, but
right,
there will be residual. How is there any robustness to that, or is the things explode very badly?
When we have the Turek code, it would be like stable if we turn on some. The ground state would be stable if we turn on some magnetic field. But in terms of decoders, I've been thinking of independent noise on everything. So let's have a look at what I'm going to talk about in the talk. So the main theme is the color code. And the first result I will explain to you is the relation between the color code and the Turek code. Then I will tell you how to perform computation with the color code. In particular, I will describe how to achieve a universal gate set with the color code in three dimensions. And in the last part of the talk, I will focus on the performance of the color code. In particular, I will mention decoders of the color code in two or three dimensions. And I will also discuss how one can compute or find out what the thresholds of the color code are. So, so that we're on the same page, stabilizer codes, which were introduced by Daniel, they are basically defined by the stabilizer group. Stabilizers are product of Pauli operators, and the code space is plus one eigenspace of those stabilizers. And a notion closely related to a stabilizer code is a stabilizer Hamiltonian. So a stabilizer Hamiltonian is a sum of commuting terms, each of which is a Pauli operator, and the ground space of a stabilizer Hamiltonian corresponds to the code space of the stabilizer code. And an example of a stabilizer Hamiltonian would be the Ising model. But notice that the Ising model would not be like fully quantum. It could be thought of as sort of a classical code because we have just Z terms. And to perform reliable error correction, we need to repeat stabilizer measurements, and the outcome of stabilizer measurements, which we call the syndrome, tells us what we need to do in order to handle errors appearing in the system. And a generalization of a notion of a stabilizer code is a subsystem code. I will briefly introduce them when there is a need for them later in the talk. But just a quick remark is that subsystem codes are specified by the gauge group, which is a non-abelian subgroup of the Pauli. In case of stabilizer codes, they are specified by the stabilizer group, which is an abelian subgroup of the Pauli group. Okay, so let's have a look at the the most famous example of the topological code, the Turek code. So we may consider a manifold, say a two torus, without boundaries or with boundaries, which I soon introduce. We can represent it as a grid, L by L, and we will place qubits on edges. And And for each vertex and for each placket, we would introduce x vertex term and z placket term. So x vertex term has x operators acting on qubits neighboring a given vertex. Z placket term has z Pauli z's acting on qubits neighboring a placket. And the stabilizer Hamiltonian for the toric code is sum of all x vertex and all z placket terms. And it is not difficult to show that those terms commute. And if they are far apart, they trivially commute. If they are neighboring, then they share two qubits, thus they commute. So the code space would be the ground space of the Hamiltonian. And in case, so note that not all z placket and not all x vertex terms are independent. Namely, if we multiply all x vertex terms, we would get identity, which, because each qubit will be taken into account twice. So in the case of z plackets. So from that, we can conclude that in case of the toric code on the torus, the degeneracy of the ground space would be 4, or in other words, this code encodes two logical qubits. Representatives of logical operators are non-contractible loops of Pauli operators. And here, for instance, x can depict logical x, green can depict logical z operator for one of the logical qubits. However, to imagine building a toric code on a torus in the real-life experiment is a bit of a stretch. So we need to consider codes with boundaries. So in particular, we can define the toric code on a lattice with boundaries. In case of two-dimensional toric code, there would be two types of boundaries, rough and smooth. Along rough boundary, we needed to modify plackets. Namely, we removed those edges. Along smooth boundaries, we needed to modify vertex terms. We removed edges as well. And when I talk about violated stabilizers, I also think of, one can think of excitations living in there. And namely, whenever there is violated X vertex stabilizer, I can think of an electric particle sitting in there. Whenever there is a placket violated, I can think of a magnetic flux sitting in there. So I have two types of particles, E and M. And in the bulk of the toric code, I can always create particles in pairs. So I can always create a pair of electric or a pair of magnetic charges. However, at the boundary, I can create a single particle, I can condense them on the boundary. And in case of the toric code, I can move electric particles to the rough boundary, and I can move magnetic particles to the smooth boundary. And in case of two-dimensional toric code, on a lattice with two rough and two smooth boundaries, this code has one logical qubit with logical operators being strings of x's and z's. And those logical operators can be implemented by creating a magnetic flux on one smooth boundary and dragging it to the other boundary. And similarly, logical z can be created as can be implemented as by creation of electric charge here and dragging it all the way down. So the code I'm interested the most is the two-dimensional color code. It can be defined on any lattice, which is two-dimensional, given such a lattice satisfies two conditions. The lattice has to be three-valent and three-colorable. Three-valent meaning three edges meet at every vertex, three-colorable, that two adjacent faces are colored into different colors. And unlike in the case of the toric code, I would place qubits on vertices. So here's how it looks. And the stabilizer Hamiltonian is defined by only placket terms. For each face, each and every face, I have x placket and z placket. And the stabilizer Hamiltonian is sum of all x and all z placket terms for every placket. One can show that those terms commute, but we need to use the properties of our lattice, namely three colorability and three valence. And the code space is, as usual, the ground space of the stabilizer Hamiltonian. But now, if we have a color, if we define the color code on a manifold with genus G, then the degeneracy would be 2 to the 4 G. Or in other words, such a code encodes 4 G logical qubits. And note that it's twice as many as for the toric. This will be important later. So in the same way, we can define the color code on a system with boundaries, on a lattice with boundaries. But this time, we would have three types of boundaries, green, blue, and red. And colors tell us what faces, what is the color missing along given boundary. Now we would have more excitations. We would have electric excitations of red, green, and blue type, similarly magnetic of red, green, and blue type. And in double, we can create excitations in triples. For instance, if there is a Z error happening here, it causes, it creates three electric charges in the vicinity. And now we can move all those charges to boundaries of the corresponding color. And such a color code encodes one logical group. So now let's focus on the first result I will present, which is the equivalence of the color code and the toric code in two or more dimensions. And what is also important is that we provide an explicit construction of a unitary mapping. And so let's see how the result fits into the bigger picture. So an important question in condensed matter physics is we would like to understand what quantum phase is out there. And this is a central problem. However, it's a difficult one. If we have a better understanding what quantum phases are available, we might be able to come up with an example of a self-correcting quantum memory in three dimensions. Maybe that's not possible. That's still an open problem. But definitely exploring the classification of quantum phases could help us to understand if we can achieve self-correcting quantum memory in three dimensions. What we do is for two gap states, we say that they are in the same phase if they are related by a local unitary evolution. So what I mean in the talk, the two codes are equivalent. I mean by that that ground states of stabilized Hamiltonians associated with those codes are in the same quantum phase. So what was known, results by Ben Yoshida and Henkel Bombin, is that in two dimensions, stabilizer Hamiltonians with local interactions and certain symmetries are equivalent to the toric code. So how does our result fit into the picture? Well, we go into discussion beyond two dimensions. And for the equivalence of the color code and the toric code, we don't need to make any assumptions on the lattice. And we also include boundaries in the discussion. And we provide an explicit mapping how one is related to the other. So let's see how a transformation in two dimensions might look like. So as I said earlier, the color code on a manifold, on a given manifold, encodes twice as many qubits as the toric code. So this suggests that the color code might be equivalent to two copies of the toric code. So now let's make an ansatz of what could be two toric code lattices on which those two copies of the toric code could be supported. So we're given a color code lattice, and let's find out what two toric code lattices might be. So we have two copies, and I would argue that if we were to shrink red plaquettes in the first copy and redraw the lattice, and if we were to shrink blue plaquettes in the second copy and redraw, those would be two good toric code lattices, where I would have toric code qubits placed on vertices. Our unitary, which we're trying to find, should transform x vertex and z plaquette terms of the two toric codes into x and z plaquette terms of the color code. So in particular, we would like to map, for instance, this ZZZ plaquette term of the toric code with blue qubits. We mapped on Z plaquette the color code, and an X vertex on the pink terror code cube is to be mapped on this bracket of the color code. So such a unitary exists, and it is a tensor product. It can be expressed as a tensor product of unitaries supported on green plackets. And I don't want to go into the details how exactly the unitary looks like, but very briefly, it can be specified by rules. Basically, it maps two body XX on the color code qubits onto two body XX of the Torr code qubits, and two body ZZ is mapped to single body Z term. And such a unitary satisfies commutation anti commutation rules. So let's have a look at the case with boundaries. So, as I said earlier, in the case of the Torr code with boundaries, we have two types of excitations, electric and magnetic. And we know that if we have some excitations, then on a gap boundary, we cannot condense excitations which have mutually non-trivial statistics. So what it means for the Torr code is that we can drag electric charge to the rough boundary and magnetic charge to the smooth boundary, but we cannot condense them on the same boundary. So, but now let's look at what happens if we were to fold the Torr code. So imagine you have like a sheet of paper, you just fold it. So then E1 depicts electric charge in the front layer, M2 magnetic flux in the rear layer. And note that I can move E1 to the right boundary because there is a rough edge. I can also move M2 to the rough boundary because in the back there's smooth edge. So I can denote this edge by the set of anions which condense here, which is E1 and M2. Similarly, I can describe the top edge by E2 and M1. But how about this diagonal edge? Well, what I can do is I can bring electric E1 and E2 together, and they would annihilate each other, which corresponds to annihilation of electric charges in the bulk of the Torr code. So this edge can be described by E1, E2, and M1, M2. So what it means is that there is a correspondence between anionic excitations in the Torr code and the color code given here. So let's see how it works in practice in detail. The color code should be also with boundaries should be equivalent to the Torr code. So let's consider the color code with boundaries, the triangular one. And now what we can try doing is we can apply a local unitary on green plackets, the unitary I described to you a minute ago. So what it does, it transforms operators on red qubits onto operators on blue or pink qubits decoupled with each other, except for this edge. And note that the difference between the case without boundaries is that two copies of the Torr code, blue and pink, are decoupled here, but not along the green boundary. So now what we can imagine to visualize that system better is basically to unfold. So I unfold it, I redraw the lattice, and we can see that this is the patch of the Torr code with boundaries. So I explained to you what happens in two dimensions pictorially, but this result holds in any dimensions for systems with and without boundaries. So basically, in the dimensions, when we start with some type of the color code, which is specified by some number k, this will be mapped by a local unitary to a certain number of Torr code qubits. And what is important is that those Torr code qubits are supported on lattices, which are obtained by some local deformations of the initial color code lattice. And as I said, a similar theorem holds for systems with boundaries. Okay, so now I would like to move on and talk about computation with the color code. Here I would be talking about my work with Michael Beverland, in which we elaborated on explicit construction of the phase gate, logical phase gate, with the color code, and how to achieve universality without magic state distillation. I will also mention how to implement a non-Clifford gate, control Z gate, in the dimensions where D is at least 3 in the Turek code. And I will briefly mention some ongoing work with collaborators in which we try to estimate the cost of universality of the color code, in which universality is achieved by switching between two different types of the color. So, as I said in the introduction, we not only want to store information, we would like to perform some computation without spreading the errors too much. So a notion which is very handy here is a notion of a transversal gate, which is a tensor product of single qubit unitaries. So note that transversal gates do not propagate error, because if there is something bad happening to this qubit and we apply transversal gate, only one qubit is affected. On the other hand, if we apply a multi-qubit unitary, in principle, this error can spread over all qubits which are involved in the gate.
So is this a careful definition of transversal? I mean, you have codes where the C node is transversal, and it's obviously a two-qubit gate.
Right. So that's a very good question. So when I think about a gate which is a single-qubit gate, logical single-qubit gate, that would be a definition of a transversal gate. If I think about two-qubit gate, like C-node gate, a transversal gate would be basically between corresponding qubits in one and the other copy. Unfortunately, transversal gates are very good, but we cannot have a single code which has a transversal universal gate set. We need to somehow we need to switch either between the codes or implement non-transversal. So in particular, there are some strengthenings of those results. And one of the results I would like to mention is the result by Bravi and Koenig, in which they showed that if we have a topological stabilizer code in the dimensions, all what we can wish for is gates from the diff level of the Clifford hierarchy. So let me unpack this statement. So the Clifford hierarchy is defined recursively. And in particular, the jth level is a set of unitaries such that they take Pauli and map it to the j minus 1 level of the Clifford hierarchy. And the first level of the Clifford hierarchy is defined to be the Pauli group. We can see that the second level is the Clifford group, because the Clifford group is the set of all unitaries which take Pauli and map it to Pauli. The third level and higher levels are not groups anymore. They are sets. And if we want to achieve a universal gate set, then we do need to go outside the Clifford group. So examples of two gates which are in the div level, but not in the d minus 1 level, include the phase gate, which implements such a phase when the qubit is in one state, and the d qubit control z gate, which implements minus one phase if all qubits are in one state. So a natural question is, we have this Bravi-Koenig result, but are there any codes which saturate this hierarchy? And what I mean by that is, are there any d-dimensional topological codes which have gates from the diff level of the hierarchy? And it turns out that yes, color codes are example of such a family of codes. And moreover, it turns out that they can one can achieve universality without magic state distillation with the color code. So in this context, what I've done with Michael Beveland is we simplified an argument how to construct explicitly the logical R gate and how to achieve universality with
that. I was taking notes, and I missed your comment. What do you mean by saturate the hierarchy?
Yes. So what I mean is that, is there an example of a d-dimensional code which has the div level Clifford gate? Well, the gate from the div level of the Clifford hierarchy. Because what Bravi and Koenig tell us is that what we can wish for is at most div level, but it is not clear if one can achieve that.
Mm-hmm. So you're achieving the best that's allowed by this theorem.
That is right. Yeah. So that's why color codes, you know, seem to be so exciting. In particular, color codes admit the Clifford group in two dimensions. So here I need to briefly tell you what the subsystem color codes are, or gauge color codes. So in case of a stabilizer color code in two dimensions, stabilizers are identified with faces and volumes. So, right. And in case of subsystem code, the gate generators are defined only on faces. So for each face, we would have Z and an X operator supported on those faces. So note that those two generators commute. But if I were to take Z here and X there, then their overlap is 1. That's the anti-commute. So we see that this is slightly different than the stabilizer. And in general, in the dimensions, we can define the color code. And we can identify X and Z gate generators to be supported on X cells and Z cells. And X and Z have to be at least 2. And they sum up to at most D plus 2. So if we have equality here, we recover the stabilizer. So a very handy way of depicting a family of color codes in two dimensions is the following plot. Here, x-coordinate tells me the dimensionality where my gate generators are supported. And z-axis tells me the dimensionality of z generator. So since x and z have to be at least 2 and not greater than d plus 2 when they're added, this means that in two dimensions, I have just one type of the color code. And since there's equality here, this is the stabilizer code. In three dimensions, I would have 3 types of the color code. 2 of those would be stabilizer color code. And this one would be a subsystem color. Similarly, in 4 dimensions, I would have 6 types of the color code. 3 of them would be stabilizer, the other 3 subsystem code, and so on and so forth. So in particular, this one has X and Z supporting on faces in 2 dimensions. This one has X is supporting on volumes and Z is on faces. So let's look closer at this corner, because that's the one which is relevant to us, 3 spatial dimensions.
So why is X on a face in D plus 3 and not like a Z?
Sorry,
the opposite.
So here you have x-coordinate, which is 3, and z-coordinate, which is 2. But there's another type of the stabilizer code, which has x and z exchanged. So so as you pointed out, there is certain similarity. So you know, this code is kind of very closely related to that code. And you know, this code is very closely related to that code. Basically, if you apply Hadamard everywhere, you would map one code to the other. OK, so let's look closely at this region of the family. So what I would like to consider is the color code, which is supported on a tetrahedron-like lattice. So such a code has 1 logical cube. And the smallest instance is the 15-qubit Riedmüller code. And I have an example of such a code. It can be visualized by such a model. So we have a 7-qubit here, 7 qubits here, 7 qubits there, and 1 top. So it's a tetrahedron-like lattice. To achieve a universal gate set, we need, for instance, the following gates. The CNOT gate, the Hadamard gate, and the phase gate, R3. Note that CNOT is transversal in the color codes, because the color codes are the CSS codes, meaning that the stabilizer group or the generator group, gauge group is generated by X and Z operators, but not by mixture of those. Also, what we argue is that in this color code, the phase gate R3 is transversal, and this can be implemented by applying on every physical qubit either R3 gate or R3 inverse. What we also can see is that the Hadamard, again, is transversal in the subsystem code because it's a self-dual code. It has generators of X and Z type supported on the same cells, spaces. So how to achieve a universal gate set? This can be achieved by basically switching between those two codes. So whenever we need CNOT, we just implement it. It's transversal. When we need to implement R3 gate or T-gate, also known as T-gate, we use this code. Whenever there's a need to implement Hadamard, we switch to be in that code, and we implement Hadamard transversally, and then we switch back to the initial code. And though the switching between codes can be done in a fault-tolerant way.
So which assumption of the Easton-Nil theorem are you
violating? Yeah, that's a very good question. So we circumvent that by changing the code. We're not staying within the same code.
So their assumption is that you have a fixed code. Somehow.
Yes, yes.
And that what you have is an innovation. I think others have had a result like this.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Where you can fault-tolerantly switch between codes.
Yes, so this builds on results of Anderson and others and Hector von Bien.
And Petzinger and Reichardt.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
But is the technique that Thomas, Joachim O'Connor, and Ray came up with, is that also similar to this?
So it's not exactly the same. It has similar flavor. Yes. So we see that we can achieve a universal gate set with color codes in three dimensions without magic state distillation, which seems to be the main source of overhead at the moment. So now the question is, you know, this code switching seems to be really cool, but what is the cost? So before I address this question, let me mention that 3D color code is already challenging because it's a three-dimensional layout. It's not that easy to build an experimental system in which you have control over an array of over a three-dimensional array of qubits. And also, when we implement CNOT in those codes, it's a transversal gate, but we need to implement CNOT between every pair of corresponding qubits, which somehow requires four-dimensional layout, which is challenging. So a more realistic architecture would be to consider two-dimensional slices of, say, the color code, which we stack up. And those two-dimensional color codes have a transversal Clifford gate. And whenever we need to implement a gate which is from outside the Clifford, we would basically have a three-dimensional code. We would bring it to the two-dimensional layer. We kind of switch between the two-dimensional and three-dimensional model, implement transversal T-gate, the R3 gate, and then move it back. So that's what was discussed in the paper by Anderson and others, and Bombin. And this the term which neatly describes what's happening is the dimensional jump.
So does this gate only work on the tetrahedral
model? Yes.
So if you have one with like more boundaries, so you can have more larger qubits, I guess it doesn't work.
You don't have the T gate,
right.
But as I will explain soon, in maybe next slide or so, if you have the hypercubic lattice in the dimensions, you can implement a D qubit control Z gate, which is from the diff level as well. So, but you don't have the RD.
Okay, but I guess my main question was about having multiple logical qubits in the same block. The hypercubic lattice.
It has basically a hypercubic lattice would have d qubits, d logical qubits.
D logical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I'll talk about it next slide, in the next slide. So, very briefly, the project I've been involved into is that we looked at the qubit overhead. So it's a simplified question. We just look at the qubit overhead of code switching. And compared with the magic state distillation, it turns out that it is not better. So the main problem of the qubit overhead with this method of code switching is that when we switch into a three-dimensional code, the number of physical qubits which we need to use scales as the power of 3. So the qubit overhead is a bit unfavorable to magic state distillation.
Do you decoding protocol that you're using here, is it optimal? Like, what would you do with the
torque? Well, so we kind of look at the lower bound, and we kind of assume that what happens in three dimensions, there are no errors introduced by the switching. So, but in our considerations, we use the decoder of Delphos, two-dimensional decoder of the Delphos, which I will describe soon. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you more about the question Daniel asked, which is the D-qubit control Z-gate. So if we consider the color code on a three-dimensional simplex like Lattice, it has one logical qubit and the transversal logical RD gate. But we can consider the color code on the D-dimensional hypercube, and then it will have D logical qubits. And the natural question is to ask what transversal logical gates can we achieve there. So let's look at the two-dimensional case. This is the lattice I'm talking about. This boundary is of the same color. So are those two boundaries, opposite boundaries. So two logical operators would be string of x's, string of z's, string of x's, string of z's. And we can check what happens if we apply an R2 gate, or DS gate, on every physical qubit. So since this R2 gate commutes with z, logical z's are left unchanged. However, logical x's are kind of dressed with strings of z's. So in particular, this x will be dressed with string of z's here, which is logical z on the second qubit. And similarly, this logical qubit on the second qubit becomes logical x on the second qubit and logical z on the first qubit. So if we look closely at what happens to logical operators, we can convince ourselves that such a transversal unitary implements d-qubit logical z-gate, because that's what d-qubit logical z-gate performs on, that's what it implements on the logical level. So as Earl Campbell and Dan Brown discussed with me, Earl wrote a blog post on that. And he argued that this is interesting because it seems that 8-3-2 color code, which can be thought of as 8 qubits sitting at the vertices of the cube, such a code is the smallest interesting instance of the color code because it can be used to distill 8 noisy T states into less noisy CC Z magic state. So what this result tells us about the color code is that since we have this mapping, a unitary mapping between the color code and the color code, we can think of, what happened. So here we have the color code. It's mapped to two decoupled copies of the color code because now the boundaries are chosen in such a way that one color is missing. So we can really decouple them. And so one can verify that if we apply if we start with the toric code, apply our unitary to switch to the toric code, to the color code setting, and apply our unitary back to the toric code, then the action, the logical action of such a unitary is the d-qubit control z-gate in the d copies of the dimensional toric code. So what it means is that not only the color code saturates the Bravikian classification, but also the d copies of the d-dimensional toric code. Okay. So now I would like to talk about the last part of my talk, which is the performance of the color code. So I will start with briefly discussing the problem of decoding of the color code, And this is a project with Nicola Delfos, still ongoing. And in this project, we develop and benchmark the decoders of the color code in three or more dimensions. So the color code is really nice. It has transversal gates, unit versatility one magic state distillation. And because of that, we think that it might be a promising quantum computer architecture. But as I was arguing earlier, we need to have methods to prevent errors from accumulation. So we need to perform some sort of active error correction. And thus, we need decoders. So the question is how to decode the color code. So
sorry, I'm a little bit naive about this stuff, but I thought you would only decode at the very end.
Well, you need to keep track of what your errors are. And in particular, if you were, so just imagine that you have just, you know, some Pauli errors, X, Y, Z. But then if you apply your T gate, then you really need to, get rid of your errors before you apply T gate, the non-Clifford gate, because it.
Well, correcting the errors, I thought that's separate from decoding.
What I mean decoding is you look at your syndrome and you come up with error correction procedure.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean. So an idea here would be how to decode the color code is, since we have the mapping between the color code and the Toric code, we just map the color code into two copies of the Toric code, decode the Toric code, and we're good. However, there's a problem. Namely, if we start with a noise model, we just independent, say, the polarizing channel in the color code, then this noise model under the unitary mapping maps into a effective correlated noise model. And when we have the Toric code with correlated noise model, then it becomes less clear what the good decoders are. So this initial idea is not the best. However, we have another idea. In particular, we can use Toric code decoders to decode the color code, but not using this idea of mapping the color code to the Toric code set. So let me briefly tell you how to decode the Toric code. So if we have the two-dimensional Toric code, since it's a CSS code, stabilizers of X and Z type, we can decode separately X and Z errors. This would reduce the performance. However, it simplifies the analysis. So now I will focus on Z errors. So imagine that Z errors appear at those locations because qubits are on edges. That's how I depict my error. So the input of my algorithm, of the decoder, is the position of, is the endpoint, is the boundary of the error. Or in other words, locations of violated X star stabilized. So what I would like to get as an output of my decoding algorithm is some guess of what the errors might have happened in the system. So in particular, you know, light blue here is the actual error, dark blue is my guess. And as long as the actual error and my guess differ by some stabilizer, in this case, the stabilizer is two shaded in green packets, then I succeeded if they differ by stabilizers. However, if my guess is this dark blue operator, then they don't differ by a stabilizer. So I made a mistake and decoding failed. And the best strategy is if we observe some syndrome S, then we pick the most probable equivalence class of errors consistent with the syndrome. Here, errors are equivalent if they differ by a stabilizer. So what, for instance, a good decoder of the Toric code does, the minimum weight perfect matching decoder, it picks the most probable error, not the most probable equivalence class of the error. And such a decoder is efficient and close to optimal. So now I'll tell you what Nicola did in two dimensions. So the decoding of the color code seems to be more challenging because if an error happens, then excitations are created in triples. A single Pauli beat a tuple of excitation. So from now on, I will switch to the dual lattice. So dual lattice is obtained from the primal lattice by replacing faces by vertices, vertices by faces, and so on. And the color code can be defined on any lattice built of triangles or tetrahedra or d-simplices, as long as vertices are colorable, meaning two neighboring vertices are colored into different colors. And in the dual lattice picture, qubits are identified with triangles, stabilizers are identified with vertices, and they are supported on neighboring qubits. So the idea is, if we have a two-dimensional color code, the syndrome, which is a zero-dimensional object, the subset of vertices, we use that to estimate an error, which is a two-dimensional object, some subset of triangle. And instead of going directly from zero to two dimensions, we'd like to go through one dimension. And that's, let me describe pictorially how the decoder works. So imagine that those qubits are affected by some error. Then when we measure stabilizers, those stabilizers are affected. And the decoder works in the following way. We consider sublattice of just red and green vertices. We perform our favorite toric code decoder, say perfect matching. We get some subset of edges. We consider red-blue sublattice. We perform the toric code decoder, and we perform the toric code decoder on green-blue sublattice. And we combine those decoding schemes. What we get is a collection of loops, and the decoder the last step of the decoder is to fill up the loops. So we fill them up, and this is our correction procedure. This might fail if we obtain some loops which are non-contractible. And as you can see, initial error and our correction canceled each other here and here. Here, however, we implemented a stabilizer, but that's harmless because our code space is not affected. So what we've been doing is basically we use the same idea to analyze color codes in three or more dimensions. And difference between two dimensions and higher dimensions is that in higher dimensions, we not only have point-like excitations, we would have higher dimensional excitations. So in particular, we not only have string-like operators, but also in three dimensions, we have sheet-like operators. So the idea to decode is fairly simple. We just need to consider a lattice, which is built of tetrahedra, for instance, depicted here. And qubits are identified with tetrahedra, and stabilizers are identified with edges and vertices. The goal of the decoder is to start from some syndrome, which is zero or one-dimensional, depending which logical operator we're trying to understand. And we would go through one and two dimensions to arrive at three dimensions using the toric code decoders. So in particular, for the zero-dimensional excitations, we would project onto six pairs of colors, four choose two, or four sublattices in case of one-dimensional excitations. And we would use toric code decoders separately. And then we would merge those results and arrive at the error correction procedure. And I would like to point out to you that this goes beyond perfect matching. Perfect matching is basically, find pairings of pairs of excitations so that the total length is the shortest. And here, what we're trying to achieve is we're trying to find minimum area K chain with the given K minus one boundary. And what we know is that this can be done efficiently for points, which is the perfect matching, and for N minus one chains in N dimensions, but other cases are still unknown. Okay, so the very last result, which is about the thresholds of 3D color codes. Basically, we investigated the three-dimensional color code thresholds using tools of statistical mechanics. And we achieved optimal thresholds in 3 dimensions. So the error correction threshold is the maximum error rate the code can tolerate. And if we're below the threshold, we can succeed with probability 1 if we consider the infinite system size, in the infinite system size limit. So thresholds are important because this is a figure of merit, which we might use if we compare different codes, which code is better. We might also use this figure of merit to compare which decoders are better. And it might also tell us that certain architectures are preferable to others. And it also gives us insight about resource estimates. So what was shown in the seminal paper by Dennis Landau, Kitayev, and Preskill is that to find the optimal threshold of the toric code, one can study a classical spin model. And in that case, it's the random bond Ising model. So what does this mean? It means that we have certain classical spin model. We study the phase diagram. And there are two parameters in our statistical mechanical model. That is order P, which tells us the fraction of antiferromagnetic bonds and the temperature at which we have our model. And what we can do is we can map phases. We would have some order phase and some disorder phase. And we would have some phase boundary between those two phases. And if we were to find the critical point on the Nishimori line, which is, you know, certain line where this mapping between optimal error correction and the statistical mechanical model holds, if we find this critical point here, this would tell us what the threshold for the code is. And why is that cool? That that method is very nice because it allows us to import, you know, sophisticated methods of statistical mechanics which have been developed over past 70 years, say, to a quantum information problem. So what we've done here is we basically extended this mapping. We explored what happens if we analyze the three-dimensional color code. And we studied two new statistical mechanical models. We mapped out their phase diagrams. And subsequently, we found thresholds of the 3D color code. So very briefly, as I already told you, the 3D color code in 3 dimensions comes into two types, stabilizer and subsystem code. Stabilizer code would have stabilizer on faces and volumes. Gauge code would have gauge generators on faces. So now we need to consider two statistical mechanical models to find out what the thresholds are. And those statistical mechanical models would be supported on the same type of a lattice, which is the lattice build of tetrahedra. And now we would place classical spins either on vertices, and our classical spin Hamiltonian would have 4 body terms, which are product of spins around a given tetrahedron, with coupling to be plus minus 1, chosen randomly with certain probability. And this, this spin model is relevant for the stabilizer case with stabilizer faces. And this spin model is fairly easy to analyze. And we can, for instance, we can look at the total magnetization on some sublattice and find out where the phase transition happens. And the other model, which is relevant for the gauge color code and the other type of stabilizer, is the 6-body random coupling Ising model, in which we place spins on edges. And Hamiltonian has product of 6 spins around every tetrahedron with coupling chosen randomly. And this model is challenging to study because there are gauge symmetries. And because of that, there are no local order parameters. And I would like to point out that this model is an example of a lattice gauge theory. So when it comes to numerics, there are certain challenges which we had to face. So in our simulation, we perform Monte Carlo simulation, and we also use parallel tempering technique to avoid local minima, because our spin model has a complicated energy landscape. So when you probe your configuration space, you might be stuck in a local minimum. So if you implement the parallel tempering method, you might get kicked out of a local minimum. And when one implements the parallel tempering, one has to optimize the acceptance rate. But that's maybe going into too many details. Now, a question which we had to understand is to identify when systems thermalize. So we perform some logarithmic binning of data. But then when we're near the phase transition, we observe critical slowing down. So it takes more and more time to thermalize the system. Of course, the question is, what are the suitable order parameters or quantities we have to look at to identify a phase transition? So in case of the four-body model, we looked at the finite size correlation length. In case of the six-body model, we looked at the scaling of the Wilson loops. And of course, our systems are of finite size, so we need to take into account finite size scaling effects. And given a lot of data, we needed to implement some bootstrap methods to estimate the statistical errors. So here are the numerics. The top row, basically refers to the four-body model. The bottom row refers to the six-body model. And what we obtained is the phase diagram for the four-body random coupling Ising model. So notice that each and every dot on the phase boundary was obtained by fixing the disorder and taking many samples at different temperatures. And so what we did here is we did sweeps over different over some range of temperatures, and we identified where the phase transition happens. And we did it for every dot. And from this phase diagram, we can identify what the threshold of the color code in three dimensions is. So this is the threshold relevant for the sheet-like logical operators. The other model, which is the six-body random coupling Ising model, has a phase diagram which looks more or less like that. And we can read off the threshold for the string-like logical operators in the color code in three dimensions. OK, so with that, I would like to conclude. So in the talk, the underlying theme was the color code. And as I try to convince you, with the color code, we can explore different areas of physics. We can ask questions with more condensed matter flavor, like classification of quantum phases. We can ask questions about quantum computation, how to achieve a universal gate set. Or we can ask about performance and the relation between the statistical mechanics and the color code. So with that, I would like to ask you not to think of me as the color code guy. But the color code is a very rich model, which gives us insight into many different cool problems of physics. So I think it's a very cool model we're studying. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
You briefly mentioned on the slide, when I was again taking notes, that the overhead compares unfavorably to
right.
magic state distillation. Can you expand on that? Like, is that just using best known techniques for this switching? I mean, is there possible room for improvement?
Right. So what we've done is some kind of pretty crude estimation in which we did not take into account, for instance, errors which happen when you switch to three dimensions. So, but we also didn't implement the best decoders of the color code. So there is still room for improvement. But like the initial initial results are not amazing in a sense. They don't indicate that this is the best method.
But so how unfavorable? I mean, we already know the overheads for magic state distillation are absurd.
Yes, so basically they are of the same order. So,
oh, so it's not like an order of magnitude worse.
No,
it's just
no,
similar.
No. Yes.
Okay. So it, now it's similar. Kind of two horses in the race.
Yes, okay. Yes. But we know that since magic state distillation has been around for more than 10 years, it has been optimized. And,
there's always, leaps of insight.
It's been improved.
Yes, it has been improved.
But it can be improved further. I mean, there's
Yes. But yeah, and this kind of highlights the importance of thinking of alternatives. But also, it emphasizes that it's not easy to come up with an alternative which is way better.
Are you? Is that can be a published result at some point?
That's what we're working on. Yeah.
Questions?
Maybe you've mentioned this. I'm not sure. Is there any particular reason why we focus on three colors in the color code?
So in two dimensions you need three. In the dimensions you would need d plus one, and that's how the model is defined. So I would say that's by definition.
Okay, but like, can I be subject to generalization in any way?
That's a good question. I guess you can play with models, and you could envision, defining codes on lattices with certain properties. But that's something to explore.
So if you don't want us to think of you as the color code guy, you have an alternative characterization.
I like physics, I like quantum information, so yeah, but yeah, you can call me the color code guy.
Daniel, does that mean we can call you Mr. Stabilizer?
Well, that's always been true.
More questions? Okay, so let's thank Alex again.
Thank you.